It's time for One Planet. This week, in The Power of the Desert, Mark Whittaker asks whether the world's deserts could hold the answer to our energy needs.
Between them, the great tropical deserts of the Sahara and of Arabia contain around 4.5 million square miles of arid, sun-parched terrain. Gravel plains, sand dunes, bare mountains and scree. A vast, virtually lifeless, largely uninhabited wilderness, with apparently nothing much going for it. Now, though, a German scientist is predicting a new solar age.
We have already once a change from a Earth age to solar age. That was when we went to see the Earth as the center of the universe to the Earth as rotating around the sun. This was a big revolution. Now we need the same thing for energy. So far we are taking all energies from the Earth by mining for coal and uranium and so on. And that is giving us big problems and troubles because also of the waste and of the limited resources. Now if you turn to the sun as a source of energy, then we have unlimited energy available and accessible, and it would not leave any pollution. So it is inexhaustible, plentiful, and clean.
That's Dr. Gerhard Knies. Central to his bright idea of a new solar age is the notion of taking advantage of the sunniest places the Earth has to offer. This is real blue sky thinking, after all. Best done in areas in the full glare of the tropic sun's hot rays, out in the desert.
We have plenty full of energy in the deserts. We only need a very small fraction of the deserts to harvest the energy. And we do have the technology to do so. And not only to harvest the energy there, but also, say, to either to fill it in bottles or to put it into wires and transmit it to the remaining parts of the world. This is technically possible, and economically it will be cheaper than having a solar power plant in Europe.
So you're, in your analysis then, Doctor, the deserts, the fringe areas of the world, the wastelands, if you like, become really perhaps the most important places on Earth.
They would give us the opportunity to continue with our highly developed civilization, which gives us comfort and good life, and which depends on the energy. The sun gives us 800 times the amount of energy than all humanity uses per year.
A staggering statistic, but it's not just in Germany that people are getting excited about the prospect of the deserts solving both our energy problems and our global warming crisis. In the Netherlands, Leendert Verhoef runs a solar consultancy in Utrecht.
It can really work. If you imagine the space available in deserts, it's enormous. So if you look at the space available in all deserts together, that is 20 times the primary energy consumption of the world. If you look at the Gobi Desert alone, if you cover that completely with solar energy systems, that will cover the world energy consumption.
How exactly the descendants of Genghis Khan would react to seeing the Gobi Desert turned into a vast solar power plant is a moot point for now. But in any case, what's the technology that would be required for such an undertaking?
You could imagine two types of solar energy factories. One is a very large array of static plates, colored blue or black, which entirely cover the desert surface, and they are at an angle directed towards the sun. Another image is that you have a large number of so-called solar dishes of approximately 20 to 40 square meter, and they follow the sun.
But of course, the sun's not always out, even in the desert, especially at night. But Dr. Knies says they've thought of that too.
The sun is only on at daytime, and we also need electricity at nighttime. So if you do not use the technology of photovoltaics, but if you use the solar thermal power technology, that is, we heat water, generate steam, and drive a turbine and generate electricity, we could also use the solar energy and store it in a big chunk of concrete or sand or what have you, heat that up and take from that store or storage at night the energy to generate steam, solar steam, at night. So we can provide secured power 24 hours a day with this method.
Presumably, though, there is a lot of wastage involved in this. If you're converting power and you're doing various things with the sun's energy, there's a seepage from that, isn't there?
Well, going from North Africa to, Germany or United Kingdom, you lose about 12 to 15% of that original energy. But if you have your power plant in the desert, you get 2 to 3 times as much energy anyway from the sun as if you would have placed it in UK or in Germany. So you are always on the winning side by going to the deserts. And to be able to generate heat from sun, you know, from your experience, you have to concentrate solar light. So you need blue sky, direct light, not the diffuse light. The diffuse light you cannot concentrate. So we have to go to regions where there's blue skies predominantly, and this is just the deserts.
So you concentrate the light in much the way that a schoolboy would play around with a magnifying glass, really?
Exactly, yes. Only not using just glass, but using concentrating mirrors instead of concentrating lenses.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say it's all right.
Well, here in the UK, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter, and as for the sun coming, it seems like it's been years since it's been here too. So let's go where it's warm. Israel's Negev Desert is home to David Feynman. For the last 20 years, he's been alone, almost in the wilderness, searching for his holy grail of energy from the sun. He's constructed a solar farm in the desert, full of parabolic reflectors and photovoltaic panels made of silicon. The BBC's Lapika Pelham went to meet him.
Why did you choose this particular place with canyons and gorgeous?
The place chose me. I was a theoretical physicist at the Weizmann Institute, and the first energy crisis broke out, and I was becoming very frustrated that the kind of papers I was writing contributed nothing to society. And at that time, I met a true visionary from Ben-Gurion University by the name of Professor Amos Richmond, who decided that he wanted to build an institute in the desert that would research all aspects of making deserts productive and comfortable places for mankind. So, you know, with such powerful stuff, this convinced me that this is really what I should be doing.
Professor Feynman leads me through an array of devices on display in this desert facility, all generating solar energy. So the huge panels here are the mirrors or metal panels?
Those are mirrors. What you're looking at there is actually state-of-the-art solar thermal technology and state-of-the-art iron bars being dropped. Those are parabolic trough mirrors, that is a trough with a cross-section of a parabola that follows the sun as it moves across the sky and concentrates the light onto a tube which runs along its focus. And oil is pumped through the central steel tube and is heated to something like 350 degrees Celsius. That oil then passes through a heat exchanger which converts water into steam, which then drives an old-fashioned steam turbine and generates electricity.
There are two massive tilted iron frames holding blue silicon squares. These, Professor Feynman says, have been around for some time, but are still being modified to maximize on solar energy.
Let's have some idea of scale. Israel has a population of approximately 6 or 7 million people that need to be served with electricity, and the electricity production at the moment comes from 10 gigawatts worth of power plants. Now, a 1 gigawatt solar power plant would require 12 square kilometers of the Negev and would contain something like 20,000 dishes, each dish of which would generate 50 kilowatts. But if you look at a map of Israel, then the distance from the Dead Sea down to Eilat on the Red Sea coast is approximately 120 kilometers. So if you think of putting these dishes along both sides of the road, you would need something like a 50-meter wide strip on each side of the road in order to produce your first gigawatt size power plant that would provide 10% of the country's electric power.
And the power will be transmitted through the cable?
Would be put straight into the power lines that in any case run along the side of the road.
Many of the world's desert locations are also subject to political instability. The world frequently talks about energy security, that countries and investors might be reluctant to commit to energy sources prone to political violence. Professor Feynman, however, disagrees.
A conventional electricity generating plant of a gigawatt in size would occupy approximately one city block. A solar power plant, by comparison, would occupy approximately 10 square kilometers of desert and would consist of a very large number of solar collectors. Now, one bomb on a city block would basically destroy, if that was the intention of the bomber, a 1 gigawatt conventional power plant. It would take an amazingly large number of bombs to destroy a 1 gigawatt solar plant. In particular, the kind of plant that I'm talking about would basically consist of individual collectors, each producing about 50 kilowatts. A gigawatt-sized plant would contain 20,000 collectors. So you'd need 20,000 bombs, roughly, to put that whole plant out. So from the security point of view, a solar plant is very, very much more desirable than a conventional plant.
Students have gathered for lunch in the canteen at the Department of Solar Energy and Environmental Physics. Around 36 students come here every year from around the world to explore the future of energy. If Professor Feynman's vision is to come true, in 20 years' time, the world will be self-sufficient in alternative energy.
My obsession for the last 15 years of solar research has been how to generate electricity in a completely cost-competitive manner with fossil fuel. Because if one can do that, basically one has solved the energy problem. I believe that it would be possible in the long run to generate electricity from solar energy for half a cent per kilowatt hour. If you can do that, then you can generate liquid hydrogen at about 30 cents a kilogram, which is the equivalent of something like 30 cents a gallon of gasoline. You would be making the hydrogen via electrolysis from water. So basically, it would be a completely clean form of fuel and one which is inexhaustible.
So an inexhaustible power supply, more than enough for the world and everyone in it, simply by harnessing sunshine in the desert. Are we about to ascend the sunlit uplands of energy supply, or is all this a desert mirage, the fevered imaginings of people who've spent too long in the sun? Graham Wheel is Director of European Energy for the consultancy group Global Insight. He's not a man given to flights of fancy. For him, it all boils down to maths. And yes, he says, the basic desert energy equation does add up.
I've made the calculation, for example, that if you were to use 6% of the OPEC country's surface area, you'd produce all the energy that's needed for the world. Or another calculation is nearly 40% of Saudi Arabia's surface area. That would be sufficient to generate all the energy of all kinds which is currently used.
But there's a catch. Quite a big one.
I was talking about the physics, but if we come to the cost, it's something completely different. The estimate is to install that amount of solar panels would cost $72 trillion. That's twice the world's annual GDP.
Come again?
Twice the world's annual GDP.
But hang on, we've been hearing people talking about electricity at half a cent a kilowatt hour, about solar power being the panacea for the world's energy crisis, not just now, but forever.
Oh, I don't agree that it's a cost-effective way. I think solar power has a role to play, but it's not going to be the salvation of the world's energy problems.
But it's free energy, isn't it?
The energy itself is free, but any form of energy converter, one needs to consider both the running costs and the capital costs. The running costs are virtually zero, but the capital costs are prohibitively high. The British Department of Trade and Industry have made the calculation that a medium-sized solar plant would generate electricity at a cost of 41 pence per kilowatt hour. That is to be compared with the cost of more like 3 pence, in other words, less than 3 pence per kilowatt hour for energy from coal or gas. You have to think how you're going to bring the energy to the market in a useful form and without excessive fuel losses. In principle, there are two different ways. You could build a high-tension transmission system to take it there. The other possibility is to convert it to hydrogen. Both of those are extremely expensive. The hydrogen chain is really something with which the world has very little experience. You need to electrolyze water, pressurize it, store the hydrogen, have purpose-built hydrogen tankers, reception units at the other end, then completely new distribution systems. I hate to think how much that might cost.
So this doesn't even come into your 72 trillion figure that you came up with earlier?
No, it doesn't. And whether you need to add 50%, whether you need to double it, I've no idea.
So it's the initial outlay, really, that is the stumbling block that makes this, as far as you're concerned, really, a pipe dream.
Yes, that's correct.
Still, the backers of solar power insist it's feasible, not just technically, but economically too, and that it'll make more economic sense as the technology develops and becomes more affordable, and as the price of carbon increases. Gerhard Knies is the coordinator of an organisation called TREC, which stands for the Trans-Mediterranean Renewable Energy Cooperation. Its aim is not only to produce solar power in the desert, in this case the Sahara, but to construct transfer and transmission systems which would encircle the Mediterranean. Exporter countries on the southern and eastern shores, importers on the European shore and beyond. A sort of international grid system for the Med, but one that would surely be fraught with political difficulties.
Yes, we always have a lot of political problems. We used to have political problems between Germany and France. They were fighting for the same coal and iron mines. And then they began to cooperate, and this was at the beginning of the European Union. If we begin to cooperate on a common issue, we could overcome this split, or this splitting, and if so, we should have a conference on energy security and cooperation between Europe and North Africa. And then we should start these developments, and in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, it will be just the normal case that we cooperate, and to my understanding, this is the best way of overcoming the frictions between this region and the terrorism also, because if people there get a perspective that they could export an industrial product from North Africa to Europe, they would generate a real income, and they would become our clients, and we would be their clients. And so I think this would enhance the security of living together tremendously.
But we've also seen, haven't we, in recent years, how energy can be used as a weapon as well. We've seen the Russians intermittently turning off gas pipelines to Europe. Mm-hmm. What would prevent a country in this Mediterranean ring at some point deciding to go it alone and turn the tap off, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's an interesting point. If you are the only one in a region to have, say, gas, and you are sitting at the faucet, or you can switch it off, turn it off, then the others have no other choice. So you are in control of the others. Now, with solar energy, there are many countries, each country from Morocco to Lebanon, so they could have these power plants and deliver to Europe or to others. So if one country decides it will play with a delivery as a weapon, they will just be out of business. They will run out of business. They will lose their clients because there are so many alternatives.
But Graham Wheel from Global Insight doesn't envisage the same sort of spirit of cooperation based on mutual self-interest breaking out in the world's energy markets. Not just yet. Nor does he see the countries blessed with the greatest solar power potential being in any kind of rush to harness it.
If one thinks that to a significant extent the deserts and the OPEC countries are synonymous, if one thinks that the price of oil is rather high at the moment, it's more than double where it was just a few years ago, the OPEC countries are making a very good living from selling oil at the moment. it's a little bit difficult. If I put myself in the position of one of their governments, why I should have much interest in selling solar power for the moment. If the oil starts running out, becomes very expensive, it's a different matter.
But there are solar power enthusiasts who argue the world doesn't need to wait for OPEC's oil to run out, doesn't have to rely on hot deserts, even the rainiest and murkiest of places, like, well, like Britain, are quite sunny enough, thank you. Jeremy Leggett once prospected for oil. Now he runs the UK's biggest solar technology firm. Well, we're on this rooftop, and we've got some of your various solar panels, solar tiles here. How exactly do they work?
Well, there are two types. The electric tiles replace four old concrete roof tiles. They really are providing a roof, but they're also providing, once they're bought, free electricity for decades into the future. And they look very similar, but the thermal tiles are very different in what they do. They produce hot water. They have a collector inside the tile that heats up the water, takes it down into the tank through a heat exchanger, and can provide quite a lot of your hot water. And if you put these into a home in enough quantities on the roof, and you're really careful with energy efficiency, you can provide all the electricity and all the water heating you need in that home.
So if a country, even in the murkier regions of Western Europe where it rains a lot, had these on every roof,
yeah,
what would that mean?
Well, BP have calculated what it would take to generate all the electricity that we use in our electricity profligate country. And it is actually, coincidentally, pretty much the same as the total roof space. In other words, if you put this technology on every available roof space in the UK, and that's just a tiny proportion of the land area of the UK, less than 4%, we could generate all the electricity we use. And if you think about how you can reduce the size of that target with energy efficiency, you really do begin to wonder why we need these giant coal and nuclear and gas-fired power plants any longer. And, of course, in the world we're going into, with the problems we have, global warming and gas at the end of pipelines in Russia, are we going to be able to rely on that? We don't have to.
So no need for oil, gas, coal, nuclear, but also you're saying really no need for a sort of a huge solar farm anywhere. You could actually just put them on people's roofs and it would be discreet. You wouldn't actually need any extra land area.
That's where these technologies are at. They're most strong. You get electricity and heat exactly at the point that you need it. You don't have to bother with pipelines. You don't have to bother with national borders and all the political complexities that you get with a globalized energy trade. You have a local, decentralized way of powering the future, and this is what we believe is coming, and the drivers for it are really strong, and they're to do with global warming, and they're also to do with, you know, just the sheer insecurity of getting energy in whatever form from far off places.
So what's your reaction to some of the schemes there are for putting large scale solar plants in places like the deserts, where obviously there's a lot more sun than there is here in Britain?
I think that, you know, in principle, that's a very good idea for the folks who live in and around the deserts, in desert countries where you've got lots of sunshine. You could get centralized power easily with this technology. Shipping it around the world, well, we won't need it. In Britain, we'll be producing our own power.
If this is such a godsend, really, why is it taking so long for people to twig?
I just think that the old ways of doing things tend to build up these theocracies. You go just over there to the Department of Trade and Industry, you still talk to any number of people, usually in their 50s and 60s, who cannot imagine a world where people provide power for their economies in any other way than giant boxes that you put coal, nuclear, gas into. And their rationale, when you get down to it, will be, well, that's the way we've always done it. That's the way we're going to have to do it. Well, I see the future differently, and I think growing numbers of people do. You know, Einstein said you don't solve problems with the thinking that got you into the problem in the first place. And we have a huge problem with global warming, and this kind of technology, not just solar, but all the other renewables, plus energy efficiency, that's how we're going to do it. And we're going to provide safer, securer, cleaner, localized economies in the process.
When you knock on my door.
Global warming has not only seen the world's ice caps start to melt, It's also seen the world's deserts start to expand. But now the deserts could have the power, quite literally, to halt that expansion. Solar power, something to shout from the panel on your rooftop about. Why, maybe it should have us all walking on sunshine. Goodbye.
This week's One Planet was presented by Mark Whittaker, and the producer was Neil Bowdler. Now, One Planet is on the internet every week. Just go to bbcworldservice.com, click One Planet in the programme menu.